Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, Atlanta Business Radio, another episode. I got Stone Payton, my co-host. I'm Lee Cantor. How you doing, Stone?
Good morning, sir. I'm doing well, and I've really been looking forward to this segment. We've got a studio full. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with attorney Connie Light. We're also going to get a chance to have a conversation with Ben Mancuso with Money Mailer. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from Bell Oaks Executive, Randy Hain. How you doing, man?
Doing great.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Give us a little bit of an overview first, if you would, about Bell Oaks, mission, purpose. What you guys out there doing for folks?
Well, we're a 43-year-old executive search firm headquartered here in Atlanta. We do work nationally, and our focus is really working with all kinds of companies from $10 million to $10 billion in size, helping them place managers, directors, vice presidents, and C-level executives.
So how's business? Aren't you kind of a leading indicator of our economy?
Well, it's interesting. Last few years obviously have been up and down. Last year was challenging. A lot of pre-election jitters affected our business. But really since December to now, it's been very busy. What's interesting, though, is a lot of our clients are really just replacing people. There's not a lot of new job growth. So we're doing a lot of confidential replacement.
So when they're replacing, is it because those people are let go for performance reasons or they just got other jobs somewhere else?
It's really for non-performance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a bad time to be a non-performer.
That people are paying attention now.
Yes, yes.
So what's the biggest challenge in your business? Is it securing the opportunity from an organization to go seek out talent, or is it in finding the talent?
You know, I think the biggest challenge is finding clients who are really serious and interested in finding the right talent and working with them. There's sort of a myth out there that, you know, there are tons of great people out there, and we can find them anytime we want. But it's really a little overwhelming for a company to go out to the marketplace and just find the perfect talent. And I think where Bell Oaks fits very well into that niche is we work with the client, identify what they want culturally from a skill set perspective and a leadership fit perspective, exactly what we're looking for. And then we go out and recruit that talent from their competitors or other companies. And I think that's a skill that is not as prevalent today in search firms, but Bell Oaks does it very well.
Now, how do you go about doing that, like for somebody that's maybe a middle manager that has some skills that isn't quite there yet? Like, what are things that they could be doing to get on your radar that you'll kind of find them?
You know, one of the things I would say is making sure that you're working on your brand. And one of the best ways to build a brand is using something like LinkedIn. You know, LinkedIn is the go-to resource for so many recruiting firms and anybody who's interested in networking.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure you've got a professional picture, that it gives a good bio, tells about what you do in the community. That's a great way to sort of get on the radar and get noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is be involved in the community. Do things with nonprofits, volunteer. But I'd say volunteering and working on your brand are two of the best things you can do to get an early start.
So how did you fall into this line of work? Have you always been involved in recruiting?
Well, I'm a political science grad from University of Georgia, which means I'm well qualified for absolutely nothing.
don't say that. My daughter is majoring in that at the University of Georgia right now.
Good luck. I did sort of fall into it. My first job out of college was with a company called NTW. You probably know what is NTB now. And I ran stores for that company all over Atlanta.
Yeah.
But I wound up doing a lot of interviewing for the company and found that I had a knack for it. And then I got recruited to a company we all know and love called Waffle House. And I was the vice president of people for that billion-dollar company. And I ran recruiting, training, and diversity for 4 years. And then I wanted to get off the road, had a young family at the time, and Bell Oaks recruited me about 13 years ago. And I've been there ever since.
So now you've come here to talk about a new book of yours. What's it called?
It's called Something More, The Professional's Pursuit of a Meaningful Life, and it's my third book.
Third book. Your earlier books had somewhat of a more religious tint to them?
Yeah, one of the things I do a lot of work in the Catholic Church with helping people learn how to integrate faith and work.
Uh-huh.
And my first two books sort of dealt with that. This third book, though, is really for all business professionals, and it's really just a sort of a I tapped into the 20-plus years of experience I had in human capital And everybody that I would speak to always has this desire to do something more with their life than just their work. They're looking for more than just their career. So I interviewed 20 people around the country, men and women from various backgrounds, and captured their stories along with my experiences. And I think it's a very authentic book that really addresses an unmet need.
Now, did anything surprise you?
What really surprised me the most was the people who I reached out to were so willing to share their stories, and they're very candid in the book, and I appreciate that because, you know, I don't really deal well with fluff, and I like that they were very candid and raw in the book, and I think that people who read it will identify readily with some of these stories because they're very authentic.
Now, did any of the chapters come together a little tougher than others?
You know, I had in my mind what the book was going to be, and then I did my interviews, and the book just sort of morphed over time into the final product that you can see now. I can't say that anyone was any tougher. I think maybe telling my own story at the beginning was the most challenging because I pursue a meaningful life, and I learned to do that when I left Waffle House. I wanted to get off the road and do something for my family, and so I, at an early age, had a chance to pursue that meaningful life. So that was a little painful, maybe just going down memory lane a bit.
Now, when you're pursuing something like this, this isn't something that your company said, "Hey, Randy, we need you to write a book, so I need this by the end of the month," right? Like, this was a personal pursuit of your own, right?
Absolutely. And one of the aspects of pursuing a meaningful life, in my view, is scratching your intellectual itches. And as I've gotten older, I have a desire to share, you know, my creativity, and I like to grow. So writing is something I started really at the age of 40. So I've only been writing books for the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. But it is something that I do in my spare time. I get up very early in the morning, and I'm disciplined enough to write about an hour a day, 5 days a week. And I've hooked up with a good publisher, and I just really enjoy the process.
Well, one of the things that I find very attractive about the way that you've laid this book out is at the end of each section, you've got these questions for reflection. Mm-hmm. Where did you come up with these? Are these questions you've asked yourself, or you look back and say, "Boy, I wish I would have asked myself this last time around"?
Well, it's a little bit of that in the School of Hard Knocks. But no, I read a lot of leadership books to stay current. I was sharing with one of the other guests earlier. And, you know, I read a lot of books that have fluff and their 20,000 foot views of the world, and then some are just too statistics and data driven. And I wanted to write a book that would provide opportunities for people to see, wow, that individual's like me, or that story resonates with me. And at the end of it, I wanted to stop you and make you think about what you just read. So the questions are very focused on self-reflection and making you just sort of think about what you've experienced and in your own life, and hopefully go forward and make some changes.
Now, do you find that in order to really become a leader that you have to be tapped into this community involvement and have kind of a bigger why of doing things?
I think so today. I mean, if you want to stand out from the pack, you know, I was telling, again, the guest earlier, that one of the things that makes people stand out today is authenticity, your willingness to kind of blaze your own trail. Now, you don't want to go so far off the map that no one recognizes you, but if you want to be seen today as a potential leader, I think you need to be out there fighting for the right thing, standing by your values, and getting involved in causes you care about.
And then that'll keep you aligned with, and you'll attract opportunities in the fields that maybe that are more congruent with your beliefs, and then you'll lead a more meaningful life?
I think that's potentially it. I think it's not so much the companies, although there are exceptions, but I think it's also, as you grow in your career and you're doing these things, you'll find other leaders out there more senior than you that you'll connect with. Mm-hmm. You'll see that, you know, John, who's the SVP of X, is someone just like you, and you want to work with that guy. You want to learn under him. So I find that it's not so much people to business as it is people to people.
You know, Lee mentioned, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I guess, that it wasn't like the organization said, "We need you to write this book," but I suspect it really has had an impact on your work. Speak to that a little bit. Has, and if so, how has the book impacted your work?
Well, I'm a firm believer in connecting through content. I write a lot of articles and blogs in addition to the books, and I like to share ideas, and I've always had this desire, even before I started writing, to put things in the hands of people that I care about. So putting a book in someone's hand that I've just written, especially my clients, is a powerful way to create a different kind of conversation. I'm also a lousy sales guy, so I'd rather talk about anything other than, "Will you buy from me?" So an interesting discussion, and everyone's interested in the topic, so mm-hmm. It's relevant.
Now, I know that leadership and growing leaders is an important part of your life. How do you see young people today, and how would you kind of mentor them to become leaders in the future?
Great question. I'm alternately encouraged by the millennial generation and frustrated by the millennial generation. I think they have vast potential. But I think what frustrates me the most is not enough people in our generation, and I'm a Gen Xer, and I assume we're all either that or boomers here, but I don't think we're reaching out enough in teaching and mentoring that generation on what it's going to take to be successful. Crossed mindset, we point fingers and we say, you guys need to grow up, but we need to reach out and help them. Mm-hmm. Now, on their side, I think that they need to reach out to us and let's meet in the middle. I love that they care about things that matter. I think that they're really energetic, they're tech savvy. But, you can't ask for work-life balance in your first interview for your first job. I didn't get that until I was 37.
But managing expectations is important?
Absolutely. But you know what? They need to hear that from people like us. And I talk on college campuses a lot. I was at Emory University last week talking to a group of MBAs, and I was pleasantly surprised to hear that they wanted that counsel. Mm-hmm. I have a talk called Old School is the New Trendy. And I talk about how, guys like me, even though you're going to run the world one day, my generation runs it today. We need to work together.
Right, for a while at least. Right?
At least a while.
We could do a show on each and every one of these chapters, but I wonder if you would speak to one for us a little bit this morning. And it's Chapter 8, The Illusion of Success. That title really grabbed my attention. Speak to that a little bit, if you will.
Well, I think... If you think about how we're all sort of kind of raised up through school, and when we first get into business, usually the mindset is, hey, you've got to get that degree and go race to the top, be the CEO of something, go be the best you can be, make a lot of money, buy a big house, buy a big car. And that illusion, and I call it an illusion, is really kind of forced on us. But not everyone is called to that. Not everyone is looking for that. And as you get older and you figure out that those things don't really matter, you start to crave what is really success. And, for me, I have a great family. My oldest son, Alex, has autism, so I'm very involved in special needs causes. We are very active in our parish and our church community, and I want to give back to nonprofits I work with. So these are the things as I get older that matter to me. Mm-hmm. And the chapter itself deals with two very different people. One is an author named Andreas Widmer, who wrote The Pope and the CEO. He was a young Swiss guard who worked under Blessed John Paul II. And then he went on to become a CEO, philanthropist, lost all of his wealth, and then has since become sort of a renowned international speaker and author. And he had everything and lost it, and now he's so glad that he realizes what's meaningful in life. And I compare him to my father, who never had anything and never cared to have anything. He's 74, and he's the most successful man I've ever met in my life, and he doesn't care about those things. He never did. So he will give you anything he's got, the shirt off his back, he'll help you, but he doesn't have any accumulated wealth and doesn't care. So I thought it was two interesting people to compare, and I'm grateful for my father, who I dedicated the book to him, actually, for the lessons he's taught me about that.
Before we let you go, let's get a little counsel for the hunted, for the people that are being recruited, the high marketables. Give us a few pointers, if you would, on how to handle that first incoming call from the recruiter.
When you call.
When I call, I want you to make lots of time for me.
clear the afternoon.
Clear the day, yeah. I think you need to have always have your radar up and be receptive to a professionally done call. If someone reaches out and they're courteous about your time and they want to explain an opportunity to you, just listen to it. You don't have to do anything with it. Maybe you have a friend who would be interested.
Right.
So I always encourage people, if you're not looking, that's okay. But just say, you know what, I'm not interested, but I've got a friend, and maybe pass it along. If you are interested, ask some good questions, figure out if it's a legitimate opportunity, and then talk about the next steps. But I think it's inherent or incumbent upon the recruiting firm to be professional and courteous and respectful of your time when they reach out to you. So I think take the call, see what they have to say, and act from there.
Now, in today's market, we talk a lot with startups, and they say that there's like negative unemployment for people with certain IT backgrounds. Is that the most sought after person right now?
Well, that and radio host.
Yeah. Of course. Of course.
Neck and neck.
And search firm guys who write books. Yeah. we're hot. Hot man. I think IT certainly really kind of depends on what it is. Where we are right now, I would say that finance and accounting professionals and sales leaders and marketing leaders. That's where we're doing a lot of that confidential replacement.
Right.
Last year, it was all HR. You know, it's a cyclical thing. Mm-hmm. But right now, the F&A people, the marketing and sales folks, if you're at the top of the food chain and you're not delivering results, that's probably where there's going to be a lot of churn. We don't really do a lot in the lower levels in IT, but I know from other people in the marketplace that is a hot sector.
Okay, let's make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you to have a conversation perhaps about career, but also I want to make sure that all our listeners know how to get their hands on this book as well.
Well, the book is Something More, The Professional's Pursuit of a Meaningful Life, and it's available on Amazon. It's a great discounted price. I encourage you to check it out there. You can reach me at rhain@bellokas.com. That's rhain@bellokas.com. My company is bellokas.com. Or you can go to my personal website, which is randyhain.com.
And then that'll have links to the book as well?
Absolutely, yes.
Well, Randy, thanks so much for coming down and visiting with us this morning, man.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it and enjoy being on the show.
How about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
You bet I will.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us from Money Mailer of Sandy Springs and Dunwoody, Mr. Ben Mancuso. How you doing, man?
I'm fabulous. Thank you for having me today.
So did you learn anything in that last segment?
Absolutely. And I agree with quite a bit of it.
So should we pursue what he doesn't agree with, or should we just talk about Money Mailer? So Money Mailer, I'm going to ask, because I always do, for a little bit of an overview, but I got to tell you, I'm no stranger to this logo. I've seen this mail come to my house, but let's talk about it a little bit anyway. Money Mailer, what's it about? What's the core service there?
Well, first, I'm glad that you get it at your house and you look at it and know it. That's fantastic. Well, what Money Mailer is, Money Mailer is a direct marketing firm. We've been in business for 32 years. We're a leader in the industry, and we help businesses with their local advertising. We develop ways so that they can advertise to the local market through their social media, and we integrate everything at a reasonable cost, and everything is targeted directly to the local consumer. Money Mailer also is a fantastic business opportunity. We're rated as the number one business advertising direct marketing business by Franchise Magazine this past year, and 10 of the last 12 years, I think it is, number one. So it's pretty impressive. And so there are your franchise opportunities all around the country, and there are a number of them still available here in Atlanta.
Now, has the business changed with the advent of the internet and social media and all that stuff?
Yeah, of course it's changed. And we've integrated all that, but it is still a viable method. Direct marketing, the mail, the hard copy mail is still a viable method. People love to get the mail. We call it a mail moment. They get the mail, bring it into their kitchen or wherever, and they sort the mail, and they love looking at it. And that's what businesses need to understand, that they have a one-on-one experience with the consumer. That consumer spends 3 to 4 seconds on each one of those ads. And even though the internet and social media has grown 66% over the last couple of years, we still have grown 5 to 6% from year over year, and we're slotted to grow again.
So now, do you have any tips for somebody that is putting together that ad and you've captured somebody's attention for 3 to 4 seconds? What do I do to actually get them to act, do what I want them to do?
That's a great question, and it's an important question for our business community. The first thing is they need to make the ad simplistic and readable so that there's not a lot of fluff on the ad. Okay, so
not a lot of clutter. It needs to be clean. You got to kind of understand what's going on right away.
Absolutely. You got to know what the brand is, right? And it needs to be eye-catching, okay? Eye-catching headlines so that they continually read the rest of the ad.
Because
if there's nothing to catch their eye, then they're just going to pass over it. Okay? Most people are visually adept. 65% of the people are visually adept, so you have to have something that catches their eye.
Right.
Okay? There needs to be a valuable offer. You know, like a buy one, get one, half off or something like that.
So something dramatic.
Dramatic.
Like you can't do like save 10% or 5%. That's not going to get me to try something new.
Right. The word free really catches
free
people.
Free is good. Okay.
Yeah, free is real good. And then with that free, you get the people to come to your business, and then through your service or your product, and that's what you do to maintain that customer.
Right. So your ad is just to kind of get their attention, to entice them maybe to try you the first time, but then you got to have super service when you're there to kind of earn their trust from that point forward.
Absolutely. And most of the businesses do have that type of service to maintain that customer set. But this is a way to bring that customer in for the first time.
Right. But if you have a bad product, then a good ad, that could be bad for your business.
It could hurt you.
it can hurt you pretty badly, because then word of mouth gets around real quick.
Now, you asked about internet, but I mean, these media can play together, right? Because couldn't the ad direct them to an internet
site? Like a Facebook
page
or something?
Absolutely. This is a total integration of the marketing campaign for our customers. On the ad, they can put their own website, which is a call to action to go to the website. They can put a message, like us on Facebook for an extended offer.
Right.
Put the QR code so that immediately they can go to the website with their smartphone. So it's a total integrated package, and it works hand in hand. And every business needs a total integrated marketing package. There's not one all that fits all.
Right. So now we're talking a lot about how Money Mailer impacts the business owner. Are you involved in the franchising of Money Mailer as well?
No, not per se, but if there are people out there that want an opportunity, I can get them in touch with the right people and where to go. And
so
get
you're
them
a franchise owner here in town?
I am a franchise owner in town, and I specifically work with the local businesses right here in the Sandy Springs and Dunwoody area.
So can you talk a little bit about why you chose to Money Mailer and how you went about choosing any franchise? Because you could have picked any franchise.
Yeah, you
could
have a ton of choices, right?
There were a lot of choices. Let me give you a quick background of kind of where I came from. Okay. That'll give you kind of like an understanding, too. My background is with IBM. I worked at IBM for 33 years. I'm ancient. I had one career with one company, and it was always in the finance or operational type perspective.
You know, Randy has some opportunities for you.
That's
we'll talk later.
That's what I hear. There's a lot of F&A opportunities out there. No, but I'm happy where I'm at right now. But I've been in all over different places with IBM and understanding different positions, and even had an international assignment in Japan. And so all of that taught me that what you do and how you get things done are building relationships with people. That's how things get done. And so once I retired, I was looking for something else to do.
Didn't play golf?
No.
There was no leisure activities?
Oh, there were a lot of leisure activities with my kids and what have you, but golf's not one of them. I don't hit them straight at all.
So you decided, you know what, I want to stay connected to business. I want to take a stab at being an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. I went through a franchise broker, and I looked at different opportunities. And after doing my due diligence, I found that Money Mailer was a great opportunity because of the success that they've had.
Right.
Not only the company, but also the different franchisees around the country and within Atlanta.
So did you call them?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. I went and talked to six different franchisees before I made the final decision.
Only in Money Mailer, or you talked to franchisees in other businesses?
Oh, I talked in other businesses.
What were some of the other ones that didn't make the cut?
Sign World, ServoPro, another painting company. There was also a...
Some of them were B2C, some of them were B2B?
Yes, both.
So how did you decide to you went with B2B?
I went with B2B because I like dealing with the business aspect, and to be honest with you, the consumer is sort of a little fickle.
Uh-huh. So you think if I can serve a business, I'll have that kind of reliable, you know, they'll stick with me for a while kind of thing?
Yes, if you build that relationship, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I try to do with all the local businesses. I'm not out there to go sell an ad.
Right.
If you just sell an ad, then you're just a salesman.
Right, it's more transactional. You're trying to have a deeper, kind of more consultative relationship?
Absolutely. I consult with them from the perspective of their marketing plan. Where do they want to go? How do they want to improve their business? Where do they want to make their business go to? And through that, I help them with their ad to get them to that place. And that's really what Money Mailer is all about, is helping the local business grow through that consumer that comes through their door to help them grow.
So what is your day like when you're not doing rock star media appearances like now? But
I don't know. My day may change. I kind of like this. This is kind of fun. My day is varied. And I never knew it would be that varied. But it also depends on the time of the month, where we are in terms of the mail cycle, whether the mail's got to go out and we're finalizing the mail, or whether we've just completed it. But basically what I do is I go and out in the field, talk to local businesses, helping them with their campaign, or I talk to business leaders and understanding what the needs are in the community, helping understand what's going on, keeping up with the the business trends that are out there so that I can continue to supply valuable information to the local businesses, and actually just working with them to develop an opportunity to increase their business, and prospecting, going out and meeting people and asking them, do they need my help?
So you're active in the business community in Sandy Springs, Dunwoody?
I'm starting to.
Because that's important, right? Because you got to kind of plug in so you can know who the people out there.
Absolutely. There's different networking groups, CORE and BNI, that I'm going to start to get involved with in the area here so as to learn a little bit more about what's going on in this part of the
town. Now, is there a sweet spot for type of business that this works especially well with? Is it restaurants and...
Well, people would think that, restaurants and beauty salons and automotive, but we run the gamut. Advertising for attorneys, medical facilities, schools, cigar shops, computer replacement services. Mm-hmm. It runs the gamut all over the place. I'm working with a shoe store right now. I'm working with a bar and grill, a jazz club. You name it. It's all over the lot. It's whatever business needs help in increasing their customer flow.
It surprises me a little bit. I guess it makes sense now that we're thinking about it, but it surprises me that professional services would be a good candidate for this.
Oh, professional services are fairly big. We have chiropractors, dentists, doctors, pediatrics. Everyone wants to advertise to increase their business. This is a way to get directly to the end user consumer.
Right in their mailbox.
And these are not salespeople that can go out knocking on doors. They need to have a machine that generates a consistent flow of people that maybe they should be doing business with.
Absolutely. And the other thing I didn't mention before when I was mentioning a couple of statistics, 65% of the people believe in their direct mail, what they receive in their mailbox, much more than what they receive online.
Sure.
How about that?
Yeah.
And then once you get to them that way, again, like we said, then they can take advantage of what is online and dive in a little bit deeper.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if somebody wanted to learn more, how would they find out more? Do you have a website?
Yeah, we have the overall Money Mailer website, and they can reach me at my email at bmancuso, B-M-A-N-C-U-S-O, at moneymailer.com, or they can call me directly. I'll give you my cell number. It's 678-524-3395. Again, that's 678-524-3395, and I don't have any problem talking with anybody.
Now, if they go to the Money Mailer website, then they drill down to Sandy Springs, Dunwoody, and that'll get to you?
They can do that via a zip code, yes, and then it'll drill down.
So they just put the zip code they're interested in, and then the right one will come to you?
Yes.
Good stuff.
All right. Well, thanks for coming and visiting us, man.
Well, thank you for having me. I think I want to do this gig again.
Well, we'll
tomorrow.
Have to have you
we'll
back.
We'll have you sometime. Back tomorrow.
Yeah, but no, it might be fun to have him come back with a couple of clients and talk about their experience. That could be fun.
We can arrange that.
All right.
You going to hang with us while we visit?
Oh,
absolutely.
Thank you.
Terrific. So next up is the undercard we're done with.
Right.
We're ready for our
headliners.
She's been waiting very patiently, nodding her head, taking a few notes, and looking forward to a very engaging and inspiring conversation. Please welcome to the show, Miss Connie Light.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So, attorney, that can cover a broad range of things, but where do you aim your efforts?
Well, I'm primarily a business attorney, and my specialization is in international business. I'm also a business consultant, so I combine both the business acumen and the legal acumen to help businesses grow. That's my focus.
And this is a good town for international business. We've
That's
had quite a few people come through. How many consulates? There's 75, 80 consulates here in town?
There are.
What's going on?
There are indeed. It is a growing international community, and particularly in terms of the Southeast, other than Miami, it probably is the most international city in this part of the country.
Is it because of the international airport? Is that one of the drivers or the cost of living? Like what makes Atlanta kind of that? An international city?
I think the airport is. And Ross Perot, actually, about 15 to 20 years ago, predicted that Atlanta would be quite an international hub because of its airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm sure the airport authority would be glad to hear this plug.
So what are some of the issues that come up in your work as an attorney that focuses on international?
Well, right now, and part of the reason for the name of my talk is just double-digit growth. I mean, everybody wants to grow their company. The economy is hard, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And how do you begin to get that growth? Well, double-digit growth is happening in a number of countries outside of the U.S., and for that reason, 70% of the CEOs surveyed last year said that they do have plans to expand internationally in 2013. When we come to, when we think about double-digit growth, of course, China comes to mind, but there are many countries closer to the United States that also have double-digit growth that the language might be a little easier to learn than Chinese.
And what are those countries?
Well, Argentina, for example, is one of those.
Yeah.
Brazil is also growing at a very rapid rate right now.
Is there opportunities in Brazil with the Olympics?
There are. Brazil is just exploding at this point in time. There is a tremendous amount of crime that is of concern, but economically it's a very strong country. And, of course, its population is also a very good consumer population for almost all of the U.S. brands, as is Asia for that matter.
But is it a little more expensive? For instance, if we wanted to set up a handful of studios in Argentina or Mexico or even Canada, is that going to be a little more expensive for us? Maybe
no, we just call Connie and she'll take care of it, right?
Absolutely. So this is one of those famous attorney answers, which is,
it depends.
So it really depends, first of all, on what you're going to call cost. Uh-huh. Because if you're just looking at how much it costs for an office space, that's one thing. But if you're taking into consideration the cost of labor, if you're taking into consideration the cost of taxes, then that's a totally different matter. For example, in New York, if you set up a business, you're going to be taxed pretty heavily on your worldwide income.
We consider New York a foreign country down here, just so you know.
But you can, for example, set up in some countries where when you import, when you repatriate those dollars back into the U.S. from your mm-hmm. worldwide income, you would actually pay less than 5% U.S. tax on those funds.
Oh, so you're saying that it might be less expensive to be in a foreign country than it would be in a more expensive or highly taxed city in the U.S.?
Absolutely. In fact, we are one of the most expensive countries in which to operate. We also have some of the greatest competition of any market in the world. So that, for example, you could go to a place that's rich in capital right now in Asia, Singapore, China, Hong Kong. You could have very little competition in certain areas, spend the same amount of money and actually dominate that market and make it easier to go from one Asian country to another, where in the U.S. you could spend that amount of money and maybe, if you're lucky, get 5% of the market.
So that's an interesting strategy. So say if somebody wanted to make that kind of pivot in their thinking, because that's changing kind of how most people think, right? Like if you have a business here in the U.S., you think, well, I'll expand here in the U.S., and then at some future point, I'll go international. You're challenging our thinking by saying, you know what? You're doing a great job where you're at. Why don't your first move be international? Right?
Absolutely. It's like, for example, I had a client in Texas, has a new technology, one that will actually disrupt, for example, the cable industry. And I was talking to them about going international, and they were saying to me, well, look, we haven't saturated the U.S. market yet.
Right.
And I'm like, I'm just saying, but have you – look at your projected cost of saturating the U.S. market.
Right.
Right now we could – and also through strategic alliances, which is a low-cost way, you don't have to go in and set up a company. You don't have to go in and meet all the different requirements. Instead, you can actually create a strategic alliance with a partner that's already set up there,
mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry about the double tax, possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And you could end up, for the same amount of money as it might cost you to enter into a new state, you could actually begin to dominate a market in a new country. This is particularly true with emerging technologies. If a technology doesn't exist in an area, you've got a certain amount of education, time, and money that it
right.
takes to be able to develop the market. But once if you're going to do that, you might be able to do it for an entire country. And that allows you then to look at economies of scale in terms of
sure.
beginning to expand internationally that you may not have here in the U.S.
And then I would think that once you've established that and you have success in multiple countries, then to come back and dominate the United States would seem easier at that point because you already have lots of international proof that this thing is already working.
That is true. That's true. Plus, one of the things is that I was also consulted on another technology that had just come out of the military. Nothing like it. This is the brand new. This is the leading edge. I began to look at it and talk to them about international. Of course, they first wanted to exploit the U.S. market because we're ahead of everybody. And as I did my investigation, I found the exact technology in Asia, was introduced to the funder of that technology who began to develop it. And there was nobody here who even knew it. And that's one thing that if you are going to, even if you're just going to look at the U.S., if you don't know what's happening in the rest of the world, you may have your feet knocked out from under you. And that's true for whether you're an investor or whether you're a business principal or whether you're an employee of that company. You need to know, you know, what is the strength of this company and how is it going to be able to compete internationally?
Right.
And concerns around intellectual property, are those largely blown out of proportion? Or speak to that a little bit about intellectual property protection as you expand internationally.
Intellectual property protection, we're talking about patents, trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets, and to some extent concepts and ideas. These are growingly important in today's economy. It used to be 20 years ago that, generally speaking, we would not, accountants, and I will defer to my colleague over here, Ben, because I know he has a former accounting background, but usually perhaps not more than 5% of a company's valuation would go for their IP. Today, it's not uncommon for 95% in some of the emerging technologies to be based from their IP. So IP is an important aspect. Now, we have a lot of talk about how, oh, my God, nobody protects IP the way that we do here in the U.S., and that's not true. The Antoine Pillar Laws, which have been in effect for over 20 years in England and most of its protectorates, are the most aggressive protection for IP in the world, bar none. And we don't have anything close to that here in the U.S. However, that being said, I was at a recent international meeting where a leading IP attorney from the best firm in Atlanta, I won't mention names because of what I'm about to say, was saying, oh, don't worry, you know, China's gotten better. You don't have to worry about your IP in China anymore. And I said, oh, wait a minute. Are you telling me that now they allow injunctions in China? And she said, oh, no, no. I said, well, so that means that if somebody infringes on your patent or your trademark in China, that for the years it will take you to litigate and come to a resolution, they can still continue to infringe and use your mark and make money off of it. And she said, well, I guess that's true. So there are concerns, but there also are protections, sometimes even greater than what we have here.
Now, is your sweet spot companies that are about to approach the international marketplace, or is it better for them to already be there and then use you to expand their presence?
My sweet spot is any company that's willing to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, most people would think that, yes, we're just thinking about going international and therefore we need to get expertise. However, the truth is that many companies that are already international could create much greater value for themselves if they were to seek better international expertise. For example, Citicore has been well established for many, many years, probably before I was born. And yet I worked on a team to reorganize them internationally. The result of that reorganization was that they ended up paying 3% on their worldwide tax, which was many times less than what they were currently paying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a well-established company, but we were able to do a lot for them. And there are many things that can actually be done for existing companies. One is, of course, just to reduce their costs, to increase their profits, but also just in setting up an international headquarters, they may be able to increase their asset protection. They may be able to reduce their liabilities by choosing jurisdictions that are more favorable for these.
Right.
also, an existing company, oftentimes, and particularly, this is particularly true of the large companies, what they've done is they've taken their U.S. business model and they've pretty much rolled it out everywhere in the world.
Right, like as if it's this, like they're in the U.S.
Right.
They haven't customized it to their country.
And the thing is that you could take advantage of different laws or regulations in certain countries. For example, you could set up an international headquarters in one country in the EU that has a favorable tax treaty. And you could actually use that as your base for everywhere in Europe. Instead of setting up for every other EU country, you actually route your money through them. Everybody does business with this one tax-favorable country. And then when you repatriate, you're paying less than 5% tax. Otherwise, you're going to get VAT in most of these countries. You're going to get an extra, you know, 15 to 35% that they're taking out on the European side. I mean, just that little thing, for example, could save you a tremendous amount.
Right. And the most businesses don't know what they don't know, but you work in this every day, so you know all the ins and outs.
Yes, and because they're large, they think, and they are successful, that they don't think they need any further advice. Now, and let me, I'm going to ask add one other point, and that's just getting back to your IP. Also, internationally, there are some jurisdictions that it would be better to simply spin off your IP into that particular jurisdiction because it's nearly impossible to bring a suit to get at or to seize that asset in that particular jurisdiction, unlike in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
So this is another aspect, for example, of...
Do you work with companies that are foreign that are trying to get into the U.S.? Do you do the reverse of this?
I do. In fact, I just, the last time that I was supposed to show up on your show, I was getting ready to go to Bulgaria.
Right.
To what was the fastest growing company in Eastern Europe. They claim they're the fastest growing in all of Europe, but I don't know. But they were looking to expand, and they were, you know, this would be a new thing for them to expand outside of their jurisdiction. And so I was looking first to set up an international headquarters for them for the advantages that they could gain from that, and then next looking at what would be the best sequencing for them in terms of expanding internationally.
So are you on the lookout for some of these foreign companies that want to come to the U.S.?
Always.
Always.
So walk us through an engagement, if you will, a relationship with Connie Light. What happens first and what happens over the coming months as someone begins to work with you?
Well, usually the first step really is planning, and that's true for any kind of business anywhere in any aspect, and it's equally true in terms of international planning. And one thing that I think is crucial that most businesses have become aware of in recent years is simply that you start with a variety of stakeholders, both in and outside of the company. You really want their input, and it's good to establish a criteria. You know, we're going internationally. What is it you want? You know, do you want the best market return? Do you want something that is good for the business owners? Do you want something that allows us to protect our IP? Are you looking for a good tax break? So there's a variety of things, and you may want to invite some of your vendors in. You may want to invite some of your customers. You may want to, you know, look at, obviously, your tax expertise, and then varying aspects of your business. Logistics for some businesses that are selling products and goods, that's a crucial thing. So that would make a difference in terms of what we would choose.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, is fascinating. Yeah. I think it's great for our listeners, but I, as you know, have a particular interest for our own efforts.
Sure. Exactly.
Hey, radio's all over the world, darling.
All over the world.
That's right. So what's next for you? Anything in particular you're going to be pouring your energy into in the coming months?
Well, I'm looking at a couple different projects right now, and I'll continue with my people overseas. But there's one project that I've been approached with actually from an ex-IBM executive, perhaps a still existing IBM executive. But it is looking at taking direct marketing and multi-level marketing, which I believe that a hybrid is now evolving in that field to get away a little bit from the multi-level marketing taint. Mm-hmm. But we're realizing as business people that this is the fastest model or the best model to more quickly grow a market. So I see this happening in business, and this is a new business model that I'm looking at and will probably set up not just here in the U.S., which is currently existing, and it's about to really hit that critical mass where it grows very rapidly. But we will, I believe, pretty quickly set up a presence in Asia as well, And there are a couple different multiples that make that market very attractive. And I believe that we can grow that market as rapidly, although we'll do it slightly differently, but as rapidly as here in the U.S. And instead of doing maybe a typical U.S. migration, which is the U.S. goes to South America because it's close, or right. a U.S. company goes to Europe because they want, you know, their wives want to, you know, vacation or something in Europe, and then finally they go to Asia. But I think one of the things, if you don't mind me just adding this, that is crucial is that we all are afraid of the unknown.
Sure.
I have a colleague that took someone to China who was a construction firm, got them huge contracts, and they ended up not going. They just were too scared of the market. I think that in the world today, we can't afford to be too scared of the rest of the world. We do need to be well-informed, and that's why you hopefully hire people that are experts and that have experience in this, but don't be scared. There may be things, you know, beyond your wildest expectations out there. So seek, and you shall find.
Good advice. Now, if somebody wants to learn more, do you have a website?
We were actually putting together the website because we're integrating a number of different factions, and it is lawyerinternational.co, not .com, but okay. .co. So lawyerinternational.co. And you can reach me at klight@lawyerinternational.co.
And that's LIGHT.
It is. And it's Connie with a K, by the way. So it's KONNY. That's my mother's creation. and light, just like a light bulb. You can also find me on LinkedIn, or you can call 404-704-0964.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest today.
I appreciate it. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the other two guests as well.
And thank you to each of our guests. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.